Hello and hi, welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and my guest today is writer-director Jeffrey Morris, who is the founder of Future Dude Entertainment, and is in the process of producing some really, really cool television and film projects. And since space opera is close to my heart, these two projects attracted my attention almost immediately as soon as I heard of them. We have Persephone, which is a feature film about Earth survivors looking for a new home 100 years from now, and Saturn V, which is a 13-episode TV series for tweens and adults. Welcome, Jeffrey.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Now, you recently presented details, backgrounds on these two projects at the International Space Development Conference in early June. How did the panel, you presenting these projects on the panel, come about?
I was contacted by an organization called the Tau Zero Foundation. Tau Zero is very much about interstellar space travel, and their goal is to develop the engineering and the capability for travel to other stars out of our solar system. And they want to do it in the near future. I mean, they'd even like to do it in our lifetime if they could. So it's pretty cool. And anyway, one of their founding members is a friend of mine, and she was aware of Persephone and the other projects I had. And she thought, that ISDC would be a perfect place for me to promote and to discuss the project. And it was actually really neat, because I was able to get a lot of feedback, interesting feedback that actually, helped me to kind of understand how to reach both my target broad audience, but also to bring some things that the audience that's really engaged, the space audience, bring some things for them specifically as well. So it was great.
Nice. So hopefully you got some really good feedback on, I'm guessing, the science side and the speculative side for both projects.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was, we focused a lot more on Persephone. But yeah, it was, because Saturn V is very much in the development phase, whereas Persephone I've been working on since 2017. So there's a lot to show there. There's a lot going on there. Lots of animation, lots of production design work, storyboards, you name it. We've been putting it together and making it happen. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, tell us a little bit about Persephone, because one of the other things that attracted my attention is your science advisor on the film is Kevin Grazier. And I interviewed mm-hmm. him a couple of times while Battlestar Galactica was on. So I'm like, okay, we got some heavy hitters here.
Yeah. Kevin's a good friend of mine. A really good dude. I like him a lot. He's been a science advisor for me on a couple of other projects as well. An underwater project called Oceanus that we did a couple of years back, and then, which is actually being redeveloped as a new TV series, called Neptune One. But anyway, Kevin and I, getting him involved, I thought was very important. My own personal background, I've studied a lot of science throughout my life, going all the way back to early childhood. While I'm on top of it, Kevin's like in the thick of it, and so what happens is we can get this really great back and forth going, where I'm like, hey, what do you think of this? If we had this planet Proxima B, what if this happened? What if that happened? And we would talk about it. And, we ended up, he and I sort of, developed the concept of what the planet would be like. It's one thing to know that there's a planet there and to have sort of the astronomical observations that tell you, we're not directly observing the planet, right? A lot of these, we're not directly seeing them. We're seeing their gravitational effect on their star. Mm-hmm. The stars wobble back and forth, and that's how you know the planet's there. So it's not like we have a picture of Proxima B, but we can take the data and the information and go, okay, based upon what we're seeing here, the numbers, what do we think might happen? And then we kind of let our imaginations go from there. So Kevin and I started sort of designing the planet before I actually started writing the script. So that was a big part of it. So it was a lot of fun. It was like, what could this be and how could it work? And it really actually became a heavy element in what motivated and drove the story. it was really fun. So I think, you know, the sad part to me, I think, you know, Hollywood will hire these science advisors and technical advisors, but they, I think sometimes they just have them there just to put their name on it and say, yeah, we talked to a science advisor. I don't know if they're always listened to. I think Kevin would tell you they probably aren't. You know, but I mean, they'll have you around, they'll ask you questions, or whatever. But for me, it's like the science. I don't see the point in doing a science fiction film if you don't get the science right. I just don't see the point. You know, so having guys like Kevin around is a big part of making it work.
So, what is the actual story of Persephone and your, I guess, inspiration, your drive to put this story on film?
Well, a couple of things. The kind of social commentary that Gene Roddenberry would do, you know, with the original Star Trek, you know, where he basically was creating this mirror for the 1960s, setting it in the 23rd century. I thought it'd be very interesting to say, you know, I know some climate scientists and meteorologists, and you know, whether the full population wants to accept it or not, climate change is real and it's happening, and we're on a precipice right now that's very, very, very precarious. You know, there's a methane tipping point that we're looking at, where if the permafrost releases these massive amounts of methane, it may be a situation where no matter what we do, we can't reverse it. You know, and then the dominoes start to fall, and it's a very bad situation. And I think the fact that we only have a few years left to really figure this thing out, and I know some people think that's gloom and doom, but it's just science. You know, I thought it would be important to tell a story of what might be the aftermath of us not resolving this and figuring it out. And so, you know, the idea of not only the aftermath of that, of climate change, but also dealing with the idea that we never really got it together and got out into the solar system. We never really colonized other worlds. We never really did enough, you know, and to put us onto other planets. And I thought, you know, what if we literally are at a place where we want to start expanding out into the galaxy? You know, what's kind of left of humanity, you know, and we decide to target Proxima B as sort of the staging area to continue forward. And so the story's set about 150 years in the future. It follows a group of colonists who are on board the ship I call Colony One, that has, and they're kind of two factions of characters in the story. They're the characters that were in hibernation. Mary Louise Parker plays an engineer who was in hibernation. She left Earth, you know, around the turn of the century. So we're seeing her after she's been awakened from hibernation in the story. And then the other two characters that she's on a spacecraft with in the story are played by Brianna Hildebrand, who plays the pilot, Brianna Hildebrand from Deadpool, and Emil Hirsch, formerly Speed Racer. And those two are young people who were actually born on the ship, on the colony ship, en route. So they've never been to Earth. You know, Earth is like a legend to them. And so I wanted to tell a story, sort of an intergenerational story, where we pit these two groups of people together in a way against each other, where you know, you have someone who wakes up and suddenly thrown in this circumstance, and she's with these kids, and it's like, who are these people and what's going on and what happened? One of the things that Proxima B has is that it orbits very close to Proxima Centauri, which is the nearest star. And Proxima Centauri is a red dwarf star that has these really violent solar flares. It's got a lot of radiation, you know, radioactivity. And the scientists think that Proxima B, while it's in the Goldilocks zone, which is the area, you know, where life could exist, life as we know it could exist, it still would get blasted by radiation. And the radiation would be blasted so badly that they think it could potentially knock off any atmosphere that was there, and so on and so forth. So, but in my version of the story, there are volcanoes where there's an atmosphere that create an atmosphere. And they decide to put a shield on the planet, that can protect the colonists from the radiation. And, I based that on some real technology as well. And, when the colonists arrive at the planet, the shield that was sent way in advance is not operating. And they're like, what are we going to do? So they have to wake up Mary Louise's character, Tanya Baxter, they wake her up because she's the engineer who was involved in designing and implementing that radiation system. So they wake her up and they go down to the planet to try to figure out what happened. And when they get to the planet, they find out why the shield's not working. And it's a complete surprise. And it's something that humanity's never quite faced before. And it's something that that could very well happen to us. It has happened to us in terms of colonization on our own planet. So it's the kind of thing that could be an issue as we go out into the universe, you know, into the greater galaxy. So, and that's basically what the story is about. It's about these three people who crash land on this planet, and then there's a mystery, and they have to solve it. And once they start to figure it out, they begin to realize that they have a choice to make, and that choice could affect the future course of what's left of humanity. So that's what's going on.
Nice. Now, I've seen some of the, I guess, behind the scenes and development featurettes on Persephone, and what the animation you guys have come up with so far, I guess their concept art, the prototypes of the ships and the planet look really fascinating. What went into the designs of those ships and the inspiration for what? Well, I guess you said you took scientific extrapolations on what the planet would look like, but the spaceship designs really, really got my attention too.
No, thank you. I really appreciate that. I'm production designer of the film as well, and you know, I've been sort of drawing spaceships since I was a kid. Yeah. And you know, I'm one of those kids that you know, I was in 77, I was drawing all these X's and H's fighting each other, you know. I'm a big fan of spaceship designs. You know, the Eagle from Space 1999, for example, is probably my favorite spacecraft ever, sci-fi spaceship. And then followed by like the refit of the Enterprise from Star Trek, the motion picture. You know, I love those ships and I love the aesthetic. I like the ships in 2001, A Space Odyssey. One of the edicts that I have for this film that I've said to my cast and my crew and everybody is that I want to act like there's been no other space film since 2001. And I'm telling the effects artists and everybody, do not have this influenced by Star Wars in any way, shape or form. This is not influenced by Star Trek in any way, shape or form. Imagine like an action movie version of 2001. That's what we're trying to do. You know, I'm a spaceship guy. I like them. I consider them characters. I think they need to be beautiful. I think we need to be able to see them. You know, I think something that's frustrated me a lot in recent science fiction films, I shouldn't actually call them science fiction films, space films. Recent space films over the last 20 years or so is that you can't see the ships. They're edited. Everything's moving so fast and the editing's so fast that you there's no sense of beauty, you know. And while I want this movie to have a lot of propulsiveness and move quickly and keep the audience, you know, hold their attention, I'm also wanting to inspire awe, you know. And I think if you look at some of the test effect shots, we've already gotten that. It was really neat. We were at Pixamondo. They're our visual effects house. They're actually our partner in the film. They're actually investing in my movie. It's the first film they've ever invested in. And they do the visual effects for Game of Thrones and Star Trek Discovery and the new Star Wars TV series, Mandalorian. Anyway, Pixamondo, we were in their big theater and I had given them all these storyboards for these effect shots I wanted to do. And one of the shots, we put it up on the big screen and the whole group gasped. Everyone went, whoa, that kind of thing. And that's exactly what I want. And that's exactly the kind of impact that I'm wanting. To talk about the actual designs of the ships, I looked at some of the things that SpaceX is doing right now. The Blue Origin, some of the private industry space designs, Boeing stuff, things like that. And then I said, okay, if you took these kind of commercial designs that we're doing right now, and then you said, all right, let's project that forward by 80 years, right? Like, what would that look like 80 years from now? And that was really the basis of, and I started sketching a lot of ships based on that. And that's how I got to, and that plus, you know, like the interstellar spacecraft Colony One, I really looked at nuclear propulsion systems and some of the other types of means you use to actually travel between the stars. And that really informed a lot of that design, you know. So the landing craft in the show, the Aero Fox, that was really influenced by what I'm seeing going on in private industry. Whereas, and I think there's some homages in there too. There's some homages to Space 1999 and 2001 in that ship's design, as well. Yeah, I don't know. Hopefully that answers your question. You know, that's the kind of things that I looked at when I did this. But there's no Millennium Falcon in it. There's no, you know, I love the Millennium Falcon. Don't get me wrong. I think it's a super cool design. I don't know how it works. It would work in real life, but I don't care when I watch Star Wars. I think it's cool, you know. But this I care deeply. You see thrusters firing. You see the ship rotating. You see the ship decelerating. I mean, this is the first movie where you're going to get to see a ship firing its engine and doing reverse thrust in order to go into orbit, you know, and that kind of thing. It's like, you know, in so many films like Star Trek, Star Wars, stuff like that, they just get to a planet and they just drop out of warp or they drop out of hyperspace, you know, and it just doesn't really work like that. So you're going to get to see sort of the physics and mechanics of spaceflight in this film as a backdrop.
Well, I'm also a huge fan of Millennium Falcon, but the first spaceship I became obsessed with as a kid was the original Battlestar Galactica Viper. I spent a couple of years trying to teach myself how to draw mechanical designs because I wanted to make my own Viper because I knew nobody else was.
Oh, cool.
Oh, awesome. So how far along in the production process are you with Persephone? Like, do you have any projected dates? Are you still working on story development or?
Yeah, the story's locked. You know, the script is locked as of May 1st. There's one little tweak I'm going to do based upon some feedback I got from an Air Force pilot who read the script recently. I want to do a little like half page tweak, but other than that, the script is locked. We were planning to shoot in the fall, but Mary Louise Parker has a Broadway show she's doing that runs from October through January. And that's okay because it gives us more prep time. And so we're going to be shooting right at the top of February. We've already done thousands of storyboards. We've got the thing kind of plotted out and figured out. We're getting ready to do. We'll have a rough cut of the film done in the fall. Actually, I'm getting together with Mary Louise and Brianna over the summer here. And we're going to do kind of a radio play of the film. And I'm going to take that radio play and take the storyboards and the animatics and start cutting together a rough cut. And then that will become the basis of the shoot and everything. So we'll shoot in February. We've got about a month of shooting and then it's a pretty quick shoot. And then we go into post immediately and we'll be doing our post in Montreal with Pixamondo and visual effects stuff. And I'm hoping that the film will be ready for release either right before Dune, you know, in like October of 2020 or, you know, otherwise we'll probably be coming out somewhere like March, or April of 2021. So it's a ways away, unfortunately, but here's the thing. I'm hoping that we can work with people like yourself to establish an audience for this film and get people excited about watching how we make the film from the beginning. And I want the audience to be engaged with this. I mean, to me, good filmmaking there are a lot of different stories in it, you know, There's the actual film that you get to see. But, you know, for me, like the Star Wars films, for example, quite often I'm more interested in how they made the films than I am the actual film, you know. And so what I want to do is instead of giving the insight into how we're making the film after the film is done, I want to give the insight on the front end and be really open and transparent and really share our process with the world as we create this film and craft it and everything. So yes, it won't be coming out until the end of 2020. Hopefully, you know, that's the plan. But in the meantime, there'll be plenty to look at and talk about and share as we go. So that's the way I look at this. Let's do it the opposite way and get people like yourself and people like me engaged and excited.
Well, happy to help because, like I said, I'm a huge fan of space opera and deep space exploration, throwing humanity out into the harshest possible environments you can imagine and seeing how they survive, where they survive is, you know, that sort of space adventure appeals to me. And seeing new projects made outside of the studio system where you don't have to, what's the word I'm looking for? Conform to rigid studio thinking, because they've got blinders on when it comes to speculative fiction. We've all seen that. This sort of project excites me. because it's another example of independent or outside of the studio supported production where telling the story in the most inspiring way, I guess, is part of the process. You're not trying to hit, you know, point A, mark B, you know, follow the paint by number scheme because you want X amount of box office. It's like, no, give me a story that means something. And Hollywood's forgetting that, but filmmakers like yourself and other independent projects I come across are doing that. And for that, I am immensely grateful.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, I it's interesting. You know, we will probably get, have some, a major studio that will release the film, but I don't have to deal, you know, I'm making the film that I want to make. That's the beauty. And I have the support of a lot of people who, believe in what I want to do, and they're following through and helping me make the film I want to make, which has just been fantastic.
Production and distribution, two totally different animals, but
exactly. Yeah. And it's funny because it's like, I feel the same way you do. I'm very frustrated with, but you know, there's very little in the science fiction genre that's interesting to me these days. It's been for a while. I just kind of shrug, you know, it's like, what is this? You know, it doesn't do a lot for me. And I want to be challenged. I want there to be new ideas. I want to see things, you know, and the sad part is, I don't think I'm the only person out there who wants to do this. I think there are probably a lot of good scripts floating around. I think there are a lot of good ideas out there, actually. I don't think that the ideas are the problem. I think it's the system that's the problem. And I think you're absolutely right. There's kind of a paint by numbers, like, you know, they call it what, the four quadrants sort of thing, right? Mm-hmm. And you just say, all right, so we got to make sure we have this many explosions, and we have to make sure we have a romance, and we have to make sure we have, a car chase, and we have to make sure, you know, it's like boom, boom, boom. And it just starts to feel like a formula. And the formula, I think it destroys the heart of what makes cinema such a fantastic medium. You know, and you really think about the films that were being made in the, the late 60s through the early 80s. There was a lot of really interesting, challenging, creative stuff that was going on. And I felt very lucky to be alive at that time. And I think that's what's really motivating me to make the kind of films and TV projects that I'm creating. I want to get back to that vibe. I mean, I understand we have to keep modern audiences engaged and entertained, but there's something that we're missing that hasn't happened since the 80s. And I think it's just, I think the 80s was really, that was like the last time we really had great science fiction cinema.
Nice. So just from my curiosity, are you going to have any practical effects, like models for the ships?
Well, you know, it's funny. It's sad because I prefer miniatures. I love miniatures. I think they're just awesome. And, you know, as a matter of fact, like a year or so ago, I got to meet Brian Johnson, the guy who did he started out working in 2001, and then he eventually did visual effects for Space 1999, and then he went on to do visual effects for The Empire Strikes Back and Dragon Slayer and movies like that. He's amazing, and he's one of my heroes. I got to meet him and show him some of my designs, and he and I really hit it off. And we talked a lot about miniatures and models, and we actually, we're trying to figure out, could we use them for this film? It turns out that because of the constraints of our budget, it actually would cost us more, and actually, I think, cause us issues to go down that path with this. And so, you know, at some point in the future, I'm actually planning to do a project that will allow me to use miniatures more, you know, effectively. But we're talking about this film with a budget of under $15 million. So it's like, you know, which is kind of the low end you can do it, a film like this with, you know. So I think once we get closer to the $25 to $50 million range, I think I can do a lot more with miniatures. So what we are going to do, work with Pixamondo, and I'm pushing them to say, you know, if you look at like the CG work that was done in the movie Rogue One, for example, mm-hmm. they still look like miniatures, right? It's like they looked at the miniature work that was done in the first couple of Star Wars films, and then they said, okay, if we're going to do CG, which is kind of the way we do it these days, how do we make the CG look more like the miniature work? That's the kind of thing that I'm trying to do with Persephone. So, we probably will not be doing any practical miniature work in this. It'll be CG. We are building a full size spacecraft that'll be on the soundstage. We're building a full size rover, which will be, we're still figuring out where our exterior location is going to be, but we'll be driving that around for real and stuff like that. So the characters will be interacting with real and physical full size vehicles and props and that sort of thing. But as far as the spaceships are concerned, I think we're probably going to have to go more CG, just because of our budget constraints.
All I'm going to say right now is 4 to 5 inch size miniatures, 3D printed. Go for it.
Yeah. Hey, well, here's what I can tell you. We are going to definitely have props. Well, we will have miniatures and vehicles and models from this project that you will be able to put your hands on and buy. And, you know, I am deeply committed to getting this into the marketplace and making it something that an audience can touch and feel, and that'll be there. So nice. No worries on that. That'll be happening for sure.
Cool.
I love that stuff myself. Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure.
Nice. Yep. So your other project is a 13 episode TV series called Saturn V. What can you tell us about that at this stage?
Well, I would say it's something that I'm in talks with National Geographic about, which is targeted for Disney Plus. It's a show for families. But I don't want to call it a kid's show because it's not a kid's show. I would say it's family in that it's similar to, Star Trek The Next Generation in that, you know, there's no gore in it. It's not violent. It's not sexual. You know, it's targeted to a general audience, right? And which I think is important nowadays. I mean, there's a lot of the great science fiction TV that's come, of the last, 10, 15, 20 years has been pretty dark. And, you know, Battlestar Galactica is not a kid's show. It's awesome. But it's not the kind of show that I wanted my kids to watch when they were little. Firefly, fairly adult, The Expanse, another show I really like. That's an adult show, you know. What I want to do is a show that a family could watch together. It's set in the solar system in the year 2099, and it deals with the idea that there's sort of the thing I call the Sol Directorate, which is a kind of our Starfleet in a way that's connecting colonies, space colonies that exist between the Earth, the inner solar system. You know, you've got mining going on Mercury, you've got a colony on Mars, you've got colonies on the Moon, helium-3 mines, you've got space colonies at L4 and L5. There's all this kind of stuff going on. And there's a reason why all this sort of abundance has happened and things have changed. There's an economic thing. I wanted to tell a positive story. Like, we fixed climate change. We solved this. And there's a reason in the story for why they fixed it all. But it turns out that reason has a dark side to it. And it's something that when the characters find out the cost of what this abundance and this sort of utopian society, they have to find, they not only discover the root of what's behind it, but they also find out that it's something that has to be replaced if we don't want to keep committing kind of this horrible crime that it's kind of at the basis of it. I don't want to give it away. But there's a core conflict that our characters discover and have to solve. And that core conflict, if they don't solve it, this sort of beautiful utopian humanity is going to fall apart. So that's what's going on. And we have it's a group of five cadets who have been trained to go to Saturn's moon Titan. That's what's going to happen eventually. So over the course of the 13 episodes, we go all around the inner solar system, and we end up with the final 3 episodes in Saturn. So we've got 3 episodes in the Jupiter system. We've got a couple episodes in Mars and the asteroid belt. We've got episodes of so you just get to go, with the exception of we don't go further than Saturn, but you get to tour and see all the different planets in the solar system, you know, and different outposts and things. It's kind of like a Star Trek in the solar system. It's like solar system Trek, basically. So that's what Saturn V's all about. Yeah.
Cool.
So, it's going to be awesome. It's the show that I've always wanted to see. It's what I would have wanted to see as a child, and that kind of thing. That's what I'm trying to create.
So this is still in the development stages. There's no no schedule yet for shooting or broadcast.
Not yet. No, it's in the development stage. We are I'm writing the pilot right now, and we've done a ton of production design. Now, the production design is awesome for this. It's very different. It's really fun. It's bright. It's colorful. Yet believable. We get the science right again. It's very important to this. I mean, we've even plotted out the positions of the planets in 2099 and how they would travel between them and how this would all work and how, so this show has a super, super heavy science basis to it. I think even more so than Persephone. But in the midst of this, we've got this really cool, fun adventure that's, feels kind of Gerry Anderson-esque, I don't know what to say other than that. It's sort of Star Trek meets Gerry Anderson meets reality.
Nice.
Yeah. So I'm super excited about that one. Yeah.
Cool. Where can people find you online and find the best places to keep up with the process, the production of both Persephone and Saturn V?
The best place is going to be, futuredude.com. And we're going to get that updated here shortly. You can see a lot of the cool stuff we're doing and working on right now. But if you get online, you'll be able to, you'll be able to see it. So, yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
So I would say futuredude.com. Yeah. That's the starting place.
That's the hub. Cool. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So the featurette, the production featurette I saw was just delightful, and the concept art clips as well. And we'll have links to where people can find you online and more information about these projects. But Jeffrey, thank you so much for sharing your vision and these projects that we have to look forward to with us today.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm looking forward to continuing our discussion. Thank you.
You're very welcome. It's Jeffrey Morris, writer, director, production designer, and founder of Future Dude Entertainment, futuredude.com. Go check all of those projects out over there. We will be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this.
Welcome to Tales of the Black Badge, a Wynonna Earp fan podcast. WynonnaEarpPodcast.com. Thanks again for checking in, and I hope you all take care. I told that devil
to take you back. Tales of the Black Badge, presented by Tuning Into Sci-Fi TV.
Hi, I'm Aaron Ashmore from Sci-Fi's Killjoys, and you're listening to Slice of Sci-Fi.
Know how I feel about independent sci-fi. So if you know of any independent sci-fi features or web series or TV shows being made, let me know. A few little housekeeping items. The Pet Cemetery giveaway is still running for another week, so get your entries in if you want to own a copy of it on Blu-ray. The giveaway for the copy of Claudia Christian's Snack Hacks will start after the Pet Cemetery giveaway ends, so keep an eye out for that. I think that's about it for right now. Not sure if I'm going to Scares That Care again this year. That's still up in the air, but we'll see. And nope, that's it. That's it for now. If you have any questions or comments, please feel free to call. The number is 602-635-6976, or you can send me an email, summer@sliceofscifi.com. You can listen to Slice of Sci-Fi through Apple Podcasts, through Stitcher, through Google Play, TuneIn, and Player FM. And you can also leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or on Stitcher. You can follow us on Twitter at Slice of Sci-Fi. You can follow us on YouTube and Facebook as well, Slice of Sci-Fi in both locations. And of course, there's the website, sliceofscifi.com. Come on by, leave your own comments, your own opinions on reviews, articles, or even these episodes and the interviews therein. I'd like to thank everyone who is helping support the shows here and on the other shows on the network. Your donations through Patreon and through PayPal really do help keep the lights on around here. If you would like to add your support to these efforts, head on over to patreon.com/sliceofscifi. Sign up for a level. And yeah, there are perks. There are perks. Yes, right now I have more books than DVDs to give away, but eventually, hopefully that'll balance themselves out. And hopefully the next few months of perk recipients will want the books. And if you are supporting through Patreon, let me know. What's the best way to get a hold of you? Should I contact you directly through Patreon or send you a direct email? Because like I said, I'm not getting a whole lot of response when I let winners know that, hey, you're the perk winner this month. Pick a book. Anyway, again, that URL is patreon.com/sliceofscifi. Or if you just want to support every now and then, that PayPal link is paypal.me/scifisummer. And yes, PayPal supporters are eligible for perks. So keep an eye out on your emails. I'd like to also send a shout out to my favorite geek rock band, Sci-Fried, for providing the theme music here. If you want to check out more energetic geek rock by them, head on over to their website, sci-fried.com, or search for Sci-Fried on YouTube. But that'll do it for this episode. Thank you all for listening. We will be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi next week. Take care.